This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
This is Peggy from Twister Sisters, and tonight you're listening to Chuck and Craig at Technorama. And I hear this is just going to blow you away.
Welcome to another Technorama special interview. I'm your host, Chuck Tomasi. This time, I have the honor of talking to amateur astronomer David Levy. David wears a lot of hats, but he's probably best known as the co-discoverer of the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, the comet that broke up and smashed into the surface of Jupiter back in the summer of 1994. Welcome to Technorama, David.
Well, thank you, Chuck. Thanks for inviting me to be on your program today. It's actually really good to be at the receiving end. Instead of asking the questions, I get to answer them for a change.
Well, it's my honor to have you here today.
Thank you.
Can you give a little history about David Levy? I read online somewhere that you never took an astronomy course, yet you were you always interested in the sky from a very young age?
Well, that's right. You're talking to someone who legally knows absolutely not the first thing about astronomy. The total amount of astronomy that I have had in all of my life as in a course is at Roslyn School, and you could actually call them and check the transcripts to prove that this happened. But in the fourth grade, at the beginning of the geography unit, we actually spent 10 minutes talking about the solar system. And that is the extent of my formal education in astronomy. And I enjoyed that. It kind of did something to me. But it kind of reinforced an event that had happened earlier. And that event happened on July the 4th, 1956. That is exactly 50 years ago. And I was away for the very first time at a summer camp. It was in Vermont, and it was a dark, clear, moonless night, and we had just celebrated our July the 4th. There had been a July 4th Independence Day celebration at the social hall, and our little group of four kids and two counselors was on its way back to the cabin. And I looked up, and I saw a meteor. It was not a bright meteor. It was fairly slow-moving, and it was heading towards a bright star. And that little incident was what really planted the seed, which years later sprouted into the passion that I now have for the night sky.
Wow, it's amazing you remember that specific incident.
Well, the memory is that it was July 4th. I remember coming back from the July 4th celebration. And I do remember that it was at Twin Lake Camp in Vermont. But I didn't remember which year, and I had always assumed that it was my third year, 1958, when I was 10 years old. In recent years, as we've been approaching the 50th anniversary, I did some investigation with the National Weather Service to find out what the weather was like over Vermont on July 4th of each of those 3 years. And it turned out, 57, there was a fairly bright moon, and the weather was unsettled. 58, the weather was simply cloudy. 56, the moon was new, the sky was completely clear.
Perfect.
So suddenly it told me that instead of being my last year at the camp, it was my first, and I was only 8 years old. The interesting thing is that I've since done some investigation as to where would a meteor be coming from above Vega heading towards Vega. And the only shower at the time that fits is the Omicron Draconis. And it's looking as though my very first astronomical observation might have been the first visual observation of a meteor from that stream. Because it was only discovered a couple of years before that.
Wow. Now, as you were growing up, did the seeds get reinforced in some way?
Yeah, they did, Chuck. I was at the same Roslyn School, and we were about to go for our class picnic and graduation. And I was on my way to the school when I fell off my bicycle and broke my arm. And my cousin gave me a book about the planets as a get-well present. And that was the thing that did it. By the end of that summer, I was absolutely committed to going into astronomy. I didn't want to talk about anything else. I didn't want to do anything else. And I remember my dad saying, David, it's good to have astronomy in your life, but don't make it the most important thing. And I listened to him. I didn't make it the most important thing. I made it the only thing.
Only thing.
The only thing. Although that's really not so true anymore, because now I have Wendy in my life, and she is by far the brightest and most beautiful comet that I've discovered.
Well, years later, you're doing your observations, and you discover a blurry smudge that became SL9. What was going through your head when you found that?
Well, actually, Shoemaker-Levy 9 was the 19th of 21 comets that I've discovered. So when we discovered Shoemaker-Levy 9, we had had some experience in the idea of comet discovery and what it meant and the emotions that go through your mind when you discover a comet. So when on March the 23rd, 1993, it was time to open up the observatory at Palomar. I was working with two people. I was working with Gene Shoemaker and his wife, Carolyn. We had tried to observe the night before, but somebody in the time that we were not at the observatory had opened our box of film and exposed it to light. And it turned out that we were facing the loss of a whole night of observing because we didn't have any film. But Gene kind of went through the box, and it turned out that the uppermost films offered some protection from the lower films.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to continue using those films until a few hours later we had fresh films ready. The next night was the 23rd of March. We started observing with the fresh films. It started to cloud over, and we stopped. We went outside, looked at the weather, and I said, Gene, Carolyn, I don't think the sky's that bad. Maybe we could actually continue observing. And Gene and Carolyn laughed. They said, that's it. That's our enthusiastic David. Our enthusiastic Dobby. He'll observe through anything. David, Gene said, every time we slap a film into that telescope, it costs us $4. He worded it in economic terms, which really is critical for what was to happen next. We can't afford to be taking pictures when the night is like this. I looked at the sky, I looked at Gene, and I said, Gene, do we have any of those bad films left, or have we used them up and have you thrown away the rest of them? And Gene said, no, actually, we still have about a dozen left. And I said, well, those are officially wasted, right? And he said, yeah. Well, why don't we just use those? And he looked at me and he said, let's just do it. And we loaded the bad films into the telescope, and the very first film that we took after that conversation was the first of the two discovery films of Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9.
Wow.
We took the pictures, we finished off the set. It got very cloudy, so we couldn't get the second one that we would need in order to see if anything was moving for another hour and 47 minutes. 2 days later, it was being, by this time, completely cloudy again and snowy and windy, and Carolyn is scanning those films that I took of the area near Jupiter, and she suddenly sits up straight in her chair and she says, I don't know what I've got, but it looks like a squashed comet. And there on her films was the strangest looking object any of the three of us had ever seen in our lives. And that's pretty much the discovery story of Shoemaker-Levy 9. And we found out a couple of months later, on May 22nd, 1993, that the comet was heading straight for Jupiter, and it would be colliding with Jupiter on July 16th, beginning on July 16th, 1994. And so that's really the story of how that little comet grabbed us, grabbed the three of us, whipped us off the face of the Earth and took us into orbit with it for its final orbit around Jupiter.
This is Dr. Pamela Gay from Slacker Astronomy, and you're listening to Chuck Tomasi on Chuck Chat.
really grabbed the nation and the world too, because once they found out it was going to hit Jupiter, everybody's eyes opened up and went, wow, this is going to be something you don't see every day.
It's something that you don't see every day, and it's something, it is a science story that is very unusual. Science has almost never, ever done that way. Discoveries are now made with big, multi-person, dozens of people working in a team. Yes, Gene and Carol and I were working as a team, but it was a team of three at the smallest observatory at Palomar Mountain, sitting up in the dome. I mean, that doesn't happen anymore, except with amateur astronomers, which I still am one. And it is very rare for a major discovery to be made in that way. And I'm deeply, deeply honored to be a part of the team that did it. Gene and Carolyn and I are, well, Gene passed away in 1997, but Carolyn and I and my wife Wendy remain very, very good friends and a deep, deep affection for each other. And we miss Gene very much. And the team became very closely bonded during the impacts. If you wouldn't mind, I could share a story with you.
Oh, by all means.
Excuse me. We were at the observatory together on a cloudy night about 6 months before the impacts. And Gene Shoemaker said, David, Carolyn and I want to know where you are planning to be during the impacts. And I said, well, I want to be in a place where I can observe Jupiter where it's going to be clear. So I'm probably going to be out here in California during that week. And he said, oh, well, Carolyn and I are going to be in Washington, and we're going to be part of the Clementine mission that was active at the time. And we thought we'd ask you where you're planning to be. And I said, well, Gene, as I just said, I'm planning to be out in California where, and anyway, this went back and forth, and Gene kept on saying, well, the two of us, that's two-thirds of the team, are going to be in Washington, and where are you going to be? And he kept on going back and forth, and finally he said, David, what I'm trying to say is the team needs to be together during Impact Week. Now, where are you going to be during Impact Week? And I said, oh, I'm going to be in Washington with you guys. He said, that's the right answer.
It sounds like something my boss would do to me.
Yeah, right.
Can you give the listener a little preview of what your observatory facilities look like today, or what sort of equipment is involved?
Well, the first thing, Chuck, is that we do have our looking through a refractor telescope. It's called Obadiah, and it's a 7-inch refractor that is mounted on top of an automated Schmidt camera. And whenever I want to do visual observing, I can use that telescope at star parties. It's beautiful for the planets. But I also have a 16-inch telescope that I use visually, and I'm still doing visual comet observing and visual comet hunting. My favorite thing that I do is a pre-dawn observing session where I'm out there looking through my 16-inch telescope, searching for comets, and surrounding me are three or four automated telescopes that are doing their own searches. And as I'm moving my telescope, moving from field of view to field of view, I can hear the noises of the motors of the other three telescopes moving from field to field. And it's almost like a telescope dance going on. The experience is wonderful. I just love to be out there and watch when that takes place. So essentially that, in a nutshell, is what we do when we're observing right now.
One of my earliest memories of Shoemaker Levy 9 was literally watching those images on the internet, the early internet in 1994, as the impacts were made. Has the internet made a change on the way you do your research or astronomy in general over the last 10 to 15 years?
It's had a huge impact, and I'm glad, Chuck, that you mentioned the thing about the internet in 1994. My understanding was that the Shoemaker Levy 9 impacts were the first major worldwide attack on the Internet, that people all over the world were logging into essentially a single website to look at the latest images of Shoemaker Levy 9. And between the Hubble Space Telescope and other places that were offering images, they were inundated that particular week. Now it's completely different. One of the ways that I'm searching for comets now is by reading. And I'm not just searching for comets. I'm searching for comets, for eclipses, and for supernovae. I'm doing it not in the sky that we know now, but in the sky of Shakespeare's time. It isn't enough for me to enjoy the sky that we might see tonight. I would also like to share what the sky was like 400 years ago. Not so much through the astronomical writings of the time, but through the writings of the people. So I use the Internet to log into the university that I'm a doctoral student at, and I can get to an online copy of, say, the Chronicles of Holinshed. And this is one of the primary sources that Shakespeare used for his plays. And I was able to find multiple references to eclipses of the sun and eclipses of the moon. And I was amazed. And Holinshed's Chronicles, incidentally, came out around 1580, 1575.
Mm-hmm.
So Shakespeare was alive. Shakespeare was young at the time, but this was in Shakespeare's time. And reading the description that Holinshed had of the ancient eclipses, going back to 1130, the year 1130 or 1215 or something like that, these are eclipses that are described in exquisite detail. And you read these stories, and you feel as though you were there watching those eclipses. And then you go to Fred Espenak's website on eclipses, and you can get to it by Googling Espenak, E-S-P-E-N-A-K, eclipse, and it goes to this wonderful NASA eclipse site that shows you maps of eclipses of the sun that took place throughout Earth's history, going back thousands of years. And Holinshed talks about an eclipse that took place as soon as the sun came up over England. And you can go to Espenak's eclipse site and see the map of that eclipse that shows the shadow of the moon hitting the Earth at sunrise in England. And I was amazed that Holinshed got it so accurately. How you can go back 1,000 years and get the eclipse date to the day, and that he got it right.
Wow.
So when you're hunting for comets, and you're hunting for nuggets, gold nuggets of astronomy, of which a comet is one, an eclipse in the year 11-something is also one of those gold nuggets. So when I say I go out and search for comets, I don't just do it through a telescope. I do it through old books, and I do it through the Internet that can give me access to those old books that I would never have without it. So that's a very long roundabout answer to your question about the web.
No, that was beautiful. You're searching for them in the fourth dimension. That's great. I noticed on your Wikipedia page that all of the asteroids listed, I think there were 41 of them, they're discovered as noted being discovered with someone else. Is that to validate the finding, or why is it always a team like that?
Mostly because I'm not really an asteroid searcher. Asteroids are a very fascinating byproduct of my comet search. And the asteroids have been found in two groups. There are about 150 of them that have been discovered with the team of Jean Shoemaker, Carolyn Shoemaker, and David Levy. The ones that are being found now are being found as part of the team of Tom Glinos, Wendy Levy, and David Levy. And the reason that we're part of that team is that my friend Tom Glinos, and this also relates to your Internet question, has a telescope in our backyard that he opens, operates, and closes all the way from his home in Toronto,
oh, wow.
Ontario, or not far from Toronto, Ontario. And the entire building opens, telescope turns on, does its thing, and it's a team effort that has yielded about 150 new asteroids. So we're up to about 300 asteroid finds right now, and they're through these two sources. But I don't specifically look for asteroids on my own, so that's why my discoveries are always part of teams.
Hi, this is Tom Dutchick from Immersion Presents. You're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Well, you mentioned that Shoemaker Levy 9 literally woke up the world to the fact that impacts from asteroids and comets do in fact happen. How likely are we here on Earth to get struck by such an object?
Oh, 100%. It's going to happen. Next question, Chuck.
When?
It's going to happen, and there's that adage, it's not if, but when. I think there's a certain network that a lot of us watch that I think every program they do says it's not if, but when. Mm-hmm. When will the next volcano erupt? When will the next hurricane hit? When will, and it's not if, but when. And it is a truism that as we become more familiar with the area around the Earth, the area and space around the Earth, the more surprised we are that we have not been clobbered yet, and that we have not been clobbered in the last several thousand years. But the Earth travels on a cosmic highway. But this highway is only one lane, and it only goes in one direction, and it has no on-ramps, and it has no off-ramps. It does, however, have a lot of intersections, thousands of them, every mile or so. On each of those intersections, that is a road on which another object, like an asteroid or a comet, is traveling. The only thing is, the Earth has to make sure that the comet or the asteroid isn't on that road at the spot where the Earth is when the Earth gets to it. Otherwise, there will be a collision. And there is not thing one that the Earth can do about it. There is plenty that we can do about it if we know about it in advance. We can send up a spacecraft armed with a nuclear warhead that wouldn't blow it up, but that would shock it into moving slightly to a different path. So instead of hitting the Earth, it would just miss us a little bit. So there are things that can be done. Had the dinosaurs developed that technology, they would still be here today. But we just witnessed the close approach of Comet Swashman-Lachman 3, in multiple pieces that came close to the Earth last month. This morning, about 7 hours ago, I witnessed a speck of dust from Swashman-Lachman 3 hitting the Earth. It was a meteor. I was out specifically looking for Tau Herculid meteors, which come from that comet, and I found one. Now, that meteor didn't do any damage to us. It's only about the size of a grain of sand. But just as easily, an object the size of a baseball field could have been there, and then that would have hit us. Hmm. So it's a question that as the U.S. Congress has mandated that scientists find every object that I believe is half a kilometer across or greater that is in danger of hitting the Earth. And this is being done right now through programs like Linear and Spacewatch and Catalina Sky Survey and Lonios up at Lowell Observatory, where Clyde Tombaugh discovered Pluto in 1930. But in the next generation, the third generation of these searches, a program called PanSTARRS will be able to get objects that are down to a few hundred meters in diameter. So they will actually be able to discover objects that would do only local damage were they to hit the Earth, and possibly know about them decades in advance. So the answer to your question, short answer, is, yeah, we're going to get clobbered again, but we might be able to prevent it.
If we know about it far enough in advance, which
if
is
we know
the real
about
key.
It, if we know about it far enough in advance. You know, going back to one of the first questions that you asked about my early years in astronomy, one of the things that I had to do when I was in the sixth grade at Roslyn was I had to give a speech, and the speech that I had to give was on comets. That's the topic that I chose. This was in March of 1960, and I got the speech out of a book called The Big Book of Stars, and I said that day that comets, like planets, travel around the sun. I had said that the head of a comet might be between 30 and 150,000 miles in diameter. I got that wrong. Head of a comet is really only a few miles in diameter. But I also said that Halley's Comet will not come into view until 1986, which is infinitely far in the future. Right now, we're about as far away on the other side of 1986 as we were when I gave that speech in 1960. On the foreside of 1986. And I think it's interesting just how much astronomy has changed in that time. And the observing isn't done the way we even did it in 1994 anymore. I still do it that way, but I'm actually in a minority right now.
You've worked with Gene Shoemaker in the past. We've talked about him. What do you remember most about him?
I remember that every time we loaded a film into the telescope and we started an 8-minute exposure, I would then run down, or if I were guiding, he would run down, load the next film and get it ready, and then come back up. And we would always do it as quickly as possible so that we would have about 4 or 5 minutes just to chat. I learned more from that man from those 4.5-minute lectures. And each time, I would have a question that I would ask him. And sometimes the questions would be scientific. Like, what do you think of the Drake equation? About the possibility of life occurring elsewhere in the universe. And Gene would then try to answer that in 4 minutes. And he would say things like, the equation is good, but we need to have another factor. The number of solar systems that have Jupiters in them. Because Jupiter cleaned up the area around the Earth, so we're not getting clobbered by comets every week. And the best thing about Gene is what I learned from him during hundreds of those 4.5-minute lectures. And I will never forget those. And I looked forward to them. He looked forward to them because he knew I was going to come up with something. and it was what a way of learning in 4.5-minute lecture bites.
I wish you could have recorded those. They'd be priceless today on the
internet. They would be. They would be priceless. I wish we had. The other thing was, Gene had a bit of a temper that we kind of took not too seriously. But one day, the clock that we used to measure the official time of our exposures stopped. And it, you know, was one of these clocks that's set up so that it's next set up with WWV so it gives accurate time. So suddenly we didn't have a clock. I had my watch, which was my bar mitzvah watch, which is the one I'm wearing now as we speak. And I said, well, let's use this as the official timepiece. Well, I made the mistake of taking my watch off, putting it down next to the dead clock, and making sure it was wound up, and I let it go. Well, the temperature was very cold that night. About 10 minutes later, Gene said, how long is the exposure left? I looked at the watch, and the second hand was moving 4 seconds forwards, 3 seconds backwards, 4 seconds forwards, 3 seconds backwards. And I said, oh, Gene, you're not going to like this. And I don't want you to lose your temper. He said, what? My watch is running backwards. There was this silence, and then this laughter that just laughed and laughed and laughed so hard. Carolyn came running up and said, what's going on? She said, our one timepiece is running backwards. We just laughed and laughed and laughed. Those are the kind of things you never forget.
You may have just discovered a way to save time.
Yeah, right. So the clock never did that. The clock never did that. And you see, it rings a bell every now and then. The clock never did that since then. But it was because it got so cold, it just started going backwards.
This is John Chatterton from Deep Sea Detectives. You're with Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Do you listen to music or podcasts or anything while you're doing your observing?
Yeah, I do. Most of it is classical music. I'll turn on to our local PBS or National Public Radio station.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I put on the music that Wendy has, which has a lot of country and western music. I'll listen to that. If I'm out observing for a very long time, like all night long, and I'm common hunting for 3 hours, what I may actually do is bring out a movie and put it into to the player so that I don't see the movie, but I hear the soundtrack of the movie. And then I get like a three-hour story that's going on as I'm searching for comets. And I enjoy that. There was one night I was out for a very long time, and a very, very cold night. And I was listening, as I was searching through the night sky for comets, I was listening to the soundtrack From a Beautiful Mind. And I was thinking, it has been 12 years since I've found a comet. It is a very lonely search, and I may never find a comet again. But no matter what has happened to me in my life, I have never had to go through the hell that that gentleman did in his life. And so it's kind of a philosophical thing sometimes.
Now, you even have an asteroid, 3673 Levy, named after you. Have you seen this asteroid?
Yes, I have. I've seen it, and I photographed it, and it is a not terribly unique main belt asteroid. The one that was named for my wife, Wendy, is far more interesting. That asteroid does have a remote chance of colliding with Mars or the Earth at some time in the future.
Oh, so we may end up as
6485.
We may end up as cosmic roadkill from your named asteroid.
It's unlikely, but it is a Mars crosser, so it does have a chance of colliding with Mars someday. And that's the asteroid Wendy Esther, 6485. Another asteroid that I co-discovered, which is not very much publicized, is the very first asteroid ever to be discovered that shares Mars's orbit. It orbits in the L5 position in Mars's Lagrangian points, and it always follows it.
Well, that's interesting.
And there are now a couple of asteroids that do that we know of. None that do that with the Earth, although there have to be a few, but none that have ever been discovered.
What is your most satisfying moment as an astronomer?
My most satisfying moment as an astronomer? In a sense, I'm doing it right now. When I get to share my passion for astronomy, my love of the night sky with other people, particularly younger people, I find that very satisfying. The other most satisfying moment is when I'm outside in the pre-dawn sky, and I'm with my telescope, and it's just me, the sky, and my telescope. And I'm as happy as a clam when I'm doing that. But significant, specific moments, I think those are the ones.
Your passion certainly comes through.
Thanks, Chuck. So does yours.
Are there any projects, books, or insights of what you're working on now that you can give us a sneak peek into?
Yeah, I'm working on three, and I try to work on all three of them every day, which is quite a challenge because life happens during the day, and I get interrupted. But one of them is my thesis that I was telling you about, The Night Sky in the Time of Shakespeare. The second one is an observing guide to eclipses, which I am doing for Sky Publishing Corporation, and which will be out in about a year and a half, I think. And the third one is an observing guide to meteors and meteor showers, which I'm doing for Cambridge University Press. What do all these three have in common? They all concentrate on the transient events in the night sky that can attract people's attention and that can inspire, like a meteor did with me 50 years ago, a lifetime passion for the night sky.
Where can the listener find out more information about you, your books, and your work?
Our website is for Wendy and me is www.jarnac, J-A-R-N like New York, A-C, .org, O-R-G. And that site has quite a bit about what we do, what Wendy and I are all about. Also, it's a way that if people want to actually meet us, we are going to be this summer at our own Adirondack Astronomy Retreat. It takes place in the Adirondack Mountains, just south of Plattsburgh, New York, near Lewis, New York. And from July 25th to 28th, Tuesday to Friday, we go out into the mountains and we have a little retreat there. It's very informal, and you can get more information on that retreat at our website.
Well, David, it's been a real treat talking to you.
Thank you, Chuck. I really appreciate the time we spent together today.
I've enjoyed it. And if you've enjoyed listening to this interview, you might want to check out some of the others at chuckchat.com, where you'll find links to more interviews on the Technorama page and links to my other podcasts, including Freestyle, an audio blog, and the Gmail podcast, a collection of short hints, tips, and tricks to help you get more from your Gmail account. Don't forget to join us for Technorama twice a week, where my co-host Greg and I take a lighthearted look at technology, science, science fiction, and all things geek. Thanks for listening, and until next time, a binary high five. 101.